Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with two wonderful guests about a very topical book that they have published with Harvard University Press. The book is called The Gender of Capital: How Families Perpetuate Wealth Inequality, which was published by Harvard University Press in 2023. And with me to discuss the books, I've got the authors here. Dr. Céline Bessier, who is a professor of sociology at Paris Dauphine University, and also Dr. Sybille Golak, who is a research fellow in sociology at the French National Center for Scientific Research. Céline and Sybille, welcome to New Books Network.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
It's sort of customary to ask our guests to briefly introduce themselves, tell us a little about their field of expertise and how they got interested in that field. So I would appreciate if you could do that. Maybe we can start with Sybille because I've got her first on the...
I prepared an answer for the both of us, but...
Yeah, fine. It's fine if you can do that. It's okay.
Okay. So I have to say it's not very easy for me to speak English. So I prepared my answer, but no, I can't. Yeah, I can a little bit make some adjustments, but
it's fine. I've had a lot of non-English speaking on the podcast.
So, Céline and I, we're both sociologists, and since the beginning of our careers, we've been working on economic relationships within the family. For her PhD, Céline studied how businesses are transferred in the cognac producing area, and for mine, I investigated real estate property strategies in families from different social backgrounds. And we both carried out in-depth family case studies. We followed some of these families for over 10 years. And our book tells their stories. During our PhDs, we discussed together a lot about our respective researches. And then together, we presented our work and explain how the transmission of wealth, economic capital, to use Pierre Bourdieu's concept, was based on gender inequalities. And the family sociologists or social class specialists with whom we discussed our work were convinced by the seriousness of our research, but often they considered that it concerned very specific social groups, and above all, social groups threatened with extinction. And this seems... seemed obvious to everyone for the wanderers Céline worked with, because they lived in rural areas and there are fewer and fewer farmers in France. It was already less obvious for the families I interviewed. But Bourdieu had revealed in post-war French society the growing importance of cultural capital in social reproduction. The level of education increasingly determines social achievement, and Bourdieu showed that academic success wasn't due to the individual merits, but was linked to the inheritance of cultural capital in the family. However, he insisted that it was no longer the family that validated the capital transmitted, but the school, so an external institution. So the transmission of economic capital seemed less crucial, and at the same time, family relationships seemed less directly caught up in reproduction issues. And French sociologists didn't find our work uninteresting, but perhaps not very relevant to understanding the future of our societies. But for our past, we were convinced that the mechanisms of transmission of economic capital were still structuring family relationships, and in particular, relations of domination between women and men. And we didn't give up. We launched together a collective survey in family courts and lawyers' offices. We continued to focus on economic issues. How were compensatory allowances and child support fixed? How were assets divided between ex-spouses in divorce cases? And we tried to understand how, despite a formally egalitarian gender-neutral law, inequalities between men and women with regard to inheritance and wealth continue to exist. And we were able to understand how men retain their role as heirs, as guardian of the family assets, despite the radical changes in the matrimonial institution. For example, the decline of marriage. In France today, 60% of children are born out of wedlock, and the rise in the number of conjugal breakdowns. And then there was Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century. We were familiar with his work, having trained and worked at the same institution, École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, École Normale Supérieure. Thomas Piketty's book showed that wealth inequalities were once again rising and that inheritance played a very important role in this growth. In the language of sociologists, this means that the transmission of economic capital was once again becoming a key factor in social reproduction. And the mechanisms we had observed, which we specialized in, were not a survival of friendship peasant society. We felt it was very important to revisit all our research to explain the mechanisms and their relevance to contemporary families. So this is why we wrote this book.
This is a very, very good and comprehensive overview of the book. Actually, I did want to say that you have looked at different aspects, such as, you know, inheritance law, which you mentioned, which is wonderful. Let us start with a definition maybe first, because to a lot of us, family is just this safe, affectionate haven where you're safe from all the other inequalities in the world, let's say. But you look at family as an economic institution. So you have a different definition of family in this respect. Can you please explain how you define this family and how you debunk this whole myth of family as being a place of equality or anything?
Yeah. So as Sibylle mentioned it, we started this research. I mean, we started like doing sociology at the end of the 1990s. We were students at the moment, then PhD students, and then researchers. And at that moment, at the end of the 90s, the sociology of family was all about this, like about like family as chosen relationships. So it's true in France. So in France, we have like François de Saint-Gly, but you can find also the same kind of theory about the family in England, for instance, with Anthony Giddens, or in Germany with Ulrich Beck. Like the idea that family is like chosen relationships, and when people are not so happy with these relationships, they just move on, like the divorce, for instance. And it was a very positive way of seeing family, which is not so attentive to power relationships, violence. It's more about like family, as you said, like as a haven of love and in the hardships of capitalism. And actually, we were not so convinced about that since the beginning. And our book is more on the dark side of what is going on in families, and also on the economic side of what is going on in the family. And I say the dark side because, like, and I mentioned violence because I think that what we do is also very connected to the feminist way of seeing family relationships now. which is much more attentive to domestic abuse or incest, like really the dark side. And it has to do with economic as well, and it has to do with power. And so to do that, we were not tool-less. We had like tools. And the first one was feminism. And because like in the 1970s, there were like plenty of works and books about like how family produces wealth, and why domestic labor is labor and is not counted as labor, and but it has value that could be counted. So there were sociologists doing time-use surveys, counting the work of women in family, which is invisible and unpaid. There were economists doing very important work, like valuing, trying to count, like what is the household production, mostly done by women and never counted in the GDP, for instance. So this idea that families is a place of production was already there, maybe a bit forgotten at the end of the 1990s, the beginning of the 2000s. But it was, we had like all these tools from the feminist studies. Also, we built on economic sociology and especially on Viviane Azéliz's work, and also Florence Weber, who's a French sociologist, like very who works in a very similar way as Viviane Azéliz, and both of them had this idea that it's worth studying economy inside the family. And we precise this a bit in the book. We say that family are places of production and of wealth, but also places where there is wealth circulation, control, and evaluation. And you have to see that, you have to investigate into the families, which is not easy, because of course families are private places. You cannot live in people's bedroom or kitchens. So you have to do interviews, you have to meet them, you have to spend a lot of time with them. You have to also like studying what we study, like which is like wealth, economic aspects of family at the moment of inheritance or divorce. It's like it's super private. People don't speak to that to their friends or to their neighbors. So you have to get trust from people that you work with. So it's not easy to do that, but if you have the adequate methodology with family case studies and statistics, and also what we did, which was like studying what was going on in specific places like family courts or family lawyers' offices or family notaries. We will go back to that, like because notaires in France are something particular, very specific. Then you can see that the family is an economic institution, and it's not something extraordinary. It's like on a daily basis, like you give some money to your children, you have like, if you get divorced, you have child supports, you have to deal about a couple's career, like the people have to speak about that to each other, like who will do the career, who will get the kids at 5 p.m. after school. So it has to do with the economics all the time. So yeah, so what we study in the book are those super ordinary family economic arrangements, and also we study extraordinary moments like inheritance or estate planning and divorces or separations of people who are not married, but at the moment when people have to count and make it super explicit. So yeah.
Thank you very much. And you mentioned inheritance. So I'm really interested to know what is the role of inheritance, let's say, in producing this inequality in families.
Yes, when we were doing our field work with families, we were impressed by the intensity of the economic transfers we observed, and Céline mentioned. There was day-to-day help, like looking after grandchildren, for example, but also more substantial financial help, like paying rent for a child away at college. But there were also the very important and official transfers, the inheritance of a family home, the passing on of the business. And all these economic transfers are embedded in issues of everyday solidarity. The aim is to ensure that family members can live in decent conditions in terms of housing, food, healthcare, that they have a job. But to understand these transfers and how they are organized, we also need to consider longer-term issues. These transfers are, for us, part of what Pierre Bourdieu calls family strategies of reproduction. They contribute to the transmission of social status from one generation to the next. And we observe that the family strategies of reproduction assign differentiated roles to women and men. Daughters and sons, sisters and brothers, fathers and mothers, wives and husbands. They are based on gender roles that make men the privileged holders of the assets that structure family wealth. For example, a family business or a family home. Moreover, family cases show that among different sex couples, these unequal positions of husbands and wives within their families of origin, the age gap between spouses and the gender inequality of job markets all work together to confer on men greater economic and social power over their partners. For example, if a man already owns his own home when he becomes a couple, thanks to an indivisible gift from his parents, his wife will have to adapt her career choices according to where that home is located, and she won't become a homeowner herself. And these economic inequalities become visible and increase with separation. In the 2015 French Wealth Survey, we've analyzed, being separated rather than in a couple greatly reduced the likelihood of being a homeowner, all other things being equal, but this correlation is significantly higher for women than it's for men. And our family case studies show that the financial fragility of women after separation makes them even less reliable heirs to structuring assets to family businesses and family homes. So the recent transformations in the institution of marriage haven't disrupted gender inequalities in inheritance. On the contrary, sons, brothers, and husbands enjoy economic privileges that contribute to inequalities between women and men. And by analyzing inheritance practices, we show how inequalities between families are linked to gender inequalities within the family. Family reproduction strategies which ensure that families maintain their class position from one generation to generation are based on the gender order.
And it's just a reflection, because I understand that in some countries, I personally, I'm originally from Iran, and in my country, unfortunately, women inheritance share is half of a man. So if a man gets... it would get 75%, a woman would get 25%, based on a very, very outdated notion that it's the man who works outside, not the woman. And unfortunately, it hasn't really changed. But it's obviously creates this unbalanced power relations. But what I liked about your analysis is that even in countries where it's seemingly equal, you still see the reproduction of this inequality. And again, for the benefit of the audience, you do use a lot of theory in the books. But you also, your book is also a database. You use a lot of statistics as well to kind of provide evidence for the arguments you're making. Another part of the book was about domestic relationships that I had. Well, I can talk about my personal experience, but rather you talk about this chapter. So you talk about the domestic relationships within a family. What does that show about inequality in families?
Yeah, so the book is, you're right, the book is, it's, we are social scientists, so the book we bring some data and there is and methodology is very important to us. It's not only a book, but like ideas or we don't want to make a theoretical point. I mean, we make a theoretical point with based on data that we collected, that we produced ourselves. And for us, it's what's specific to social science. And so it's because this book was done in, it's like 15 years, more than 15 years of research, we did very different things. So it's a mixed methodology, and we need this mixed methodology to do the demonstration. So we did first family case studies. So as Sybil mentioned, during our PhD thesis, Sybil was studying real estate strategies in families. I was studying family businesses. And family case studies are wonderful because like you don't only interview one person in a family, but you interview several people for a very long time with repeated interviews in time. And Sybil, for instance, she followed some people for more than 10 or 15 years. And it's interesting to interview them like every 5 years and to see the evolution of the situation. And doing these family case studies, what was fantastic was to see that people like sons, daughters, parents were not women, men, husbands, wives, were not saying the same thing about like inheritance processes or about like divorce. Like the fact that people have different point of views on the same situation. And the problem of this is the fact that it's time consuming. I mean, you cannot interview like thousands of people. It takes a lot of time because those interviews also are very long. Like it was like 2 or 3 hours interviews that we did with every person in the family, and sometimes several times. And you need this time because, as I was saying, people don't speak about like inheritance like that. I mean, you need trust. It takes some time, and so you cannot do that on a very large scale, and. Then the consequence of that was that our colleagues would say, oh, yeah, but the families that you study are specific. First of all, they are the ones who want to speak to you. So this is why statistics are interesting then. For instance, what Sybil just mentioned about inheritance, we saw that very precisely in our family case studies. Like studying, I studied a cognac family, like families who produce wine-growing families, business families in cognac. And it was absolutely obvious that the structuring asset in these families were the wine company, and the fact that if there was a son there, it would never be for a daughter. It was obvious, but people would say, oh, but this is specific. So then when we realized that in statistics, we could see that on a larger scale, that was very interesting. And we also saw that structuring assets were not only family businesses, but also real estate assets, which Sybil had studied in her PhD thesis through family case studies and the statistics. So the combination of the two methodology was very helpful. But then we added, after 2008, we added something else. We decided to, because people were saying, your families are too specific. So we were like, we need to find institutions where all families go. And this is why and how we started researching family courts. And going to family courts, because in France, like a lot of people get divorced, a lot of people are not married and they get separated or divorced if they were married. And it's massive. And these are people from all backgrounds, rural, urban, rich, poor, very different people going there, very different couples. And then studying this moment of divorces, we started to, this was a moment in front of judges, with lawyers. This was a moment when couples had in mind these economic questions and this question of inequality, because the statistic here is very clear as well. The fact that women, after divorce or separation in France, they are impoverished. They lose something like 25-30% of their income after a separation or divorce, whereas men, it's only 3%. And these statistics, I gave the French one, but it's worldwide. I mean, in different countries, we have this thing. So here we have a very explicit issue, which is the impoverishment of women at the moment of divorce or separation. And people would speak about like child support, alimonies, who get the family home after the divorce, and we were right at the right place to see that. And same thing with inheritance. So in France, we have like what in other countries, like in the United States, I guess it's the same thing in Australia, lawyers take care of everything at the moment of for inheritance, like all the questions that have to do with assets are dealt by lawyers. But in France, we have notaires, notaries, and lawyers. But these notaires are not like notaries in the United States or I guess in Australia who just draft documents. They also act as mediators. They meet everyone, and they are the one who do like who participate to the sharing of the assets between the different heirs. So we decided to study them as well to see that, and it is because of this mixed methodology that we were able to do this demonstration about like these hidden inequalities. And also there is something that we didn't mention that is very, very important. It's the fact that, as you said, France give lesson to the world about equality, right? Well, the country of freedom and equality. And we give a lot of lessons to the world about that. And at the same time, we had colleagues, Nicolas Frémaux and Marion Le Turc, who showed, like in 2020, that the gender wealth gap in France was actually widening. It gets bigger from 9% in 1998 to 15% in 2015. So this statistic that I can give you, I cannot give it to you about Australia or the UK or the United States because we don't have the data. Because the gender wealth gap is something that is quite difficult to study, to document and to measure. And we have a survey in France, which is not too bad, and we can do that. But in many countries, wealth is only counted at the household level, and you don't see what is going on inside the couples and inside the households. Like, you don't have an individualized measure of wealth. In France, we managed to do it. It's also possible in Germany, but basically these are the two countries where it is possible to do, maybe also a northern part of Europe, but that's it. And this statistic, the fact that the gender wealth gap was getting bigger, and at the same moment we had the egalitarian law, was the paradox we wanted to study in the book through this mixed methodology.
Thank you very much, Basir. That was a very good overview of the methodology, and you actually raised a lot of important points about gender gap, which is still a thing in Australia as well. But unfortunately, I don't even have the data to see if it's been widening or it's been reducing. There's something else that I'd like to ask, which is about, again, families using some strategies of social reproduction and also economic arrangements that families make, but these arrangements still maintain or perpetuate the economic imbalance or the power status of some, usually male partner in the family. Can you give an example of that, a tangible example for us to see how it works?
For example, I studied a baker's family near Bordeaux. We call Pilon family in the book. It's not their real name. And I first met the mother, Marcel. She was retired and she decided in 1992, she decided to get the bakery and its large attached house to her son, Pierre, who had been working with her making pastry. But Pierre had three sisters and they received each real estate, but the value of the sisters' shares was an order of magnitude smaller than what Pierre was getting. And in France, we've said it, inheritance is supposed to be equally shared among daughters and sons since the Napoleonic Code in 1804. And to equalize the division of assets, the notarized document thus stated that Pierre would provide two of his sisters who live nearby with free bread and pastries daily for over a decade. And on paper, this agreement could seem precise and fair if we overlook the fact that the sisters were obliged to live near their brother to enjoy the baguette and croissant that were their due. Yet, an old gift had been deliberately left out of the calculation. In the 60s, the parents had purchased a pastry business for their son, Pierre, and Pierre would later merge this business with his parents' bread bakery. And the value of a small rural pastry business is not trivial. It's 50 or 100,000 euros. But this amount was never included in the official estate partitioning. And when asked about this in interviews, Marcel told me, and her children also, they all justified the omission by the fact that Pierre had turned down alternative career choices to take over the family business, all for the good of the family. And unlike his sisters, he didn't go to high school and college. And Marcel, the mother, she claimed she had to sell a flour mill to pay for her daughter's education. And I asked the sisters explicitly about the fairness of this arrangement. And they first gave the same justifications as their mother, but they told me also that they worked at some time or other in their parents' shop for free. And while their brother was rapidly given a wage and a percentage of pastry sales. Besides, selling the mill had largely covered the cost of their studies because one left school at 17 and the other two received scholarships while working for their parents for free. But all three explained that they didn't want to quarrel with their mother and brother. And this example shows us that family strategies of social reproduction are collective. In the case of the Pilon family, it was important for Pierre's sisters that the bakery remain in the family because the shop provided a locally situated social status to the entire family. And at the collective level, there was a certain logic to the way the Pilon family planned the transfer of the family business, but also the accumulation of cultural capital by the daughters. And the parents did invest in their daughter's educations, which paid off as Monique became a school principal and Roselyne became a town councillor. And these various strategic elements permitted the accumulation of positions that maintained the family's local social status. And the notion of family strategy explains the coherence of all these decisions and why daughters, mother, women accept the unfairness of the estate planning. And families don't prepare women and men for the future in the same way. And it's visible in this case. The sisters learned it was normal to work for free as a disinterested way of helping out when the family business needed it. And they also learn it will be necessary to accumulate educational capital, in order to find wage earning work elsewhere. They Their brother learned it was normal for his work to be valued and remunerated. He enjoyed the independence and profitability of economic capital. In this way, the family produced gender individuals who were taught to play differentiated and ranked roles according to the family's social reproduction strategy. But in the book, we give more examples because these family strategies of reproduction are very different from one social background to another. And also because families from poor families and rich families don't have the same relationship with law and with lawyers and legal professionals.
And speaking of, you did mention for the example of this family. I'm also interested to know about the birth order in families and how it affects wealth inequality. What is the role of this birth order? And I understand that in older times, the eldest son had more advantages, but I'm also curious to know if this is still the phenomenon or not.
Okay, so in the 60s, Bourdieu studied the farming society in southwestern France, and he described the early choice of a male successor, and it was the first son who will carry on the family's social status, pass on the name, and become the privileged heir to its wealth. And in France, in 2015, statistical data show that inheritances and intervivos gifts received by males are more often composed of professional assets, real estate, land, and securities than those received by females. But the gap is even wider if compared between transfers to old daughters and transfers to first sons. And the specific role of first sons manifests itself not only in the nature of the assets received, but in the timing of when they are transferred. First sons are more likely to receive their lot before daughters and other sons. Inter vivos gifts make up 40% of the estate transfers to firstborn sons, against 37% of those to firstborn daughters, and 32% of the other sons' estate, against 27% for the other daughters. And to receive such an endowment early in life, it's an obvious advantage in the further accumulation of wealth during a lifetime. Is this effect of birth order on wealth inequality old? It's a tricky question because you'd think it's an old phenomenon that would soon disappear, but before 1804 in the Civil Code, inheritance law in France varied widely from region to region. Historians thus contrast egalitarian and unegalitarian regions in France. And the Southwest, studied by Bourdieu, and where I interviewed the Pilon family and where Céline studied the Cognac farms, was an unequal region. And differences in inheritance rights were due to differences in the type of property rights that peasants exercised over their land. The Southwest was characterized by full ownership, while in other regions, peasants held more usage rights over the land. Historical research shows that there, parents were more likely to distribute the rights to their land among their children, but to marry them off to well-placed landowners in order to reconstitute viable farms. And in 1804, the French Civil Code established full ownership as a dominant form of property ownership, and it not only imposed an equal division of property between children throughout France, regardless of sex or birth rank, but also a type of property right historically linked with transmission to the eldest son. And it's hard to say then whether the privilege of eldest sons in matters of inheritance is something old or something new. And there aren't many statistical surveys in which birth order is available, but this is the case for the French Wealth Survey, and I've carried out analysis of this survey, which show that all of the things being equal, eldest daughters and sons have higher levels of education. And so we see that in the transmission of cultural capital, birth order also matters. And parents don't devote the same amount of time and money to all their children. And this works in favor of sons and elders.
And what about the wealth status of the families? How does inequality work in cases where the woman comes from a wealthy family, or when she makes more money than her husband?
Yeah, thank you for this question, because it's something that we study in the book, and you have to take into account the fact that there are several dimensions. There is wealth, and there is income, there is the family of origin, and there is the couples, what is going on in couples. So to have a woman coming from a wealthier family than her partner, but she would have to have not brothers but sisters, or being like the only child to have more power on the, I mean, to have, yeah, to get more from this family of origin in matter of wealth. So here you already have two dimensions, right? And then you have what is going on the labor market, and the fact that in France, like in other countries, women still do most of the unpaid work and pay labor, whereas men in couples do more of the paid labor. So there is only one couple out of four where it is the female partner that has makes more money than her partner. So, and you have also to take into account the age difference, which is in average 3 years in France. So this is something that is not reducing, because like people have now in life, they get more divorce or separations. And as you know, men have later in life, if have are more likely to have a relationship with a partner who's like younger than them. So taking all these dimensions together, the age difference, what is going on the labor market and in couples, paid and unpaid work, what is going on in the family of origin, and with the what Sibyl just explained before in matter of inheritance, the inequality between sons and daughters, then like to have a woman in a couple with all these dimensions aligned to make her like the one like more who has like power on wealth, economic power, it's like a four-leaf clover. It's the metaphor that we found to explain that. I mean, it exists. We have met some, but there are very few, because you all these dimensions women are disadvantaged in all these dimensions. So of course, like it can exist, like a woman coming from a wealthier family than her partner, being an only child or not having brothers, and having like receiving a lot of money from her family, and then being partner with and making more money, having more income than her husband, and being older than her husband. It can exist, but it's so rare. And so what we study in the book are like partial situations. Like, for instance, there is a family that we study, the Renoir family, with a woman like Christine Renoir coming from a wealthier family than her husband. So she comes from, her parents were accountants, they are accounting business, and his parents had no wealth at all. But on the labor market, he has a better situation than her. And at one point, because in her family, she has a brother who got the family business, she's not in a super good position in her family. She would like to get her house, which is like near the... So she would like to get a house from her family, which was a kind of vacation house that she would like to make her permanent house. It's near the ocean. And she doesn't manage to do that in her family because of the family strategies of reproduction in her family. And because also her husband is super reluctant to depend on that, on her wife's, on his wife's asset. So all these situations that are more likely to exist, we study in the book. And here you realize that for women, it's difficult to be the one to have like the economic power in their couple.
So, and another area that I'm really interested to know how this inequality is perpetuated is through financial and tax arrangements, especially during separation. And I'm interested to know how that works.
Yeah. So here it's the second part of the book and what is going on like with legal professionals. So we studied notaries and lawyers and tax. So the two moments that we study in the book are inheritance, like estate planning, and separation, divorce. And those two moments are taxed. They are taxes. The tax administration is very present. And here, so it's a bit technical, but what we study in the book is how people count and how legal professionals count. And we bring in the book the concept of reversed accounting. And I will spend like 2 minutes to explain that. So at the moment of sharing an estate, like for inheritance, or at the moment of a divorce where you have to share the different assets, people in France go to the notaire. They go to the notary office. Like elsewhere in the world, they see lawyers. But basically, it's not so different. But when they do that, they try to share. Their assets. And we studied with Sibylle and the research team, we studied hundreds of notary acts. And when you see these notary acts, you have the feeling that what people do is that like they do a list, an inventory of the assets, and so a list like real estate, bank accounts, family businesses, if there is one, etc. And in front of each of these assets, there is an amount, like in euros, like a valuation of these assets. And then there is a sum and a division between the different heirs or between the two spouses. And if sometimes there are compensations, because like if one gets more, like one apartment is more than what is on the bank account, then you need to do like transfers. And you have the feelings that it's this order, like inventory, valuation, sum, division. What we realized is that actually in practice, it's exactly the opposite. So this is why we called it reversed accounting. When people step into the notary office, they already know who will get the family business. When a couple is getting divorced, people already know who stays in the family home, who stays in the conjugal home. So the distribution comes first. This is what we realized. And what is going on in the office is like discussion about like the inventory and discussion about the valuation. Here I come to the tax question. Because like inventory, so we realize that in some families, some assets were just not counted. Like a gift which was made 15 years before, or sometimes, you know, family businesses, it's difficult to count the value of it. Like sometimes you have like the building, the value of the building, but sometimes you have the value of the clientele, which is quite difficult to evaluate. And some things are just forgotten. And doing the family case studies, the different interviews, like we realized that sometimes everyone knew that there were things that were forgotten. And sometimes even the notary knew. And the valuation thing is super common. The fact that the structuring assets that we mentioned before, like real estate, land, family businesses, the most important assets are the most important economically and symbolically. And these assets are not sold. If they are not sold, what is their price? you can under-evaluate them. And people do that a lot because tax is there are taxes, and taxes depend on the amount of wealth. So these structuring assets that, as you remember, get more often to sons and get more often to male spouses, are undervalued for tax reasons. And what we realize in the book is the fact that women, as daughters, as ex-wives, they know it, and they sometimes accept it because of taxes, because of the tax administrations, because they want to pay less tax. And we realize also that legal professionals, they play a lot on the tax argument, saying, you know, you're going to pay, let's evaluate like this, then you will pay less taxes. And it's, and the tax argument is a very efficient argument for legal professionals to create some agreement between people, to create consensus. It's consensus building. Like, there is a consensus building against the tax administration, but in that creates a disadvantage to daughters and to ex-wives. So this is the dynamic of the thing.
And you also discussed child support. It's because I assumed that that would reduce, right, would reduce this element of inequality. Does it really do that? A man's responsibility to provide child support? Does it really reduce inequality?
Yeah. So to answer this question, you need to bring a lot of national context. Because, like, depending on the countries, you have, like, either at the moment of divorce or separation, you have only private transfers or private and public transfers. So in France, we're in a country where there is both. There are, like, child supports, but also, so in France, we have a family benefits office, so kind of welfare that distributes family support benefits. So it's a specific benefit for mostly mothers who didn't get child support because their ex-husband, their fathers, cannot pay it. And this, so it's, these are large amounts of money, the family support benefits. And I know that in a lot of countries, this system doesn't exist. So in the French, so I will answer you in the French system, and then I would like to elaborate a bit on the international comparisons. So in the French system that we studied with Sibyl and the research team, the thing is that the system as it exists, like with public and private transfer, so the public transfer is quite elaborate and it doesn't work so well, but there are a lot of discussion about how to improve it and all. But what we realized was the fact that these are women who have to ask, they have to do all the administrative work to get the benefits. They have to go to court. They have to ask for the divorce. They work a lot to get these benefits. But one consequence also of that is the fact that fathers, they don't pay a lot of child support in France, and which creates gender inequality. So we're in a system when there is class inequality that is taken into account in a certain way, but it builds some gender inequality. In other systems, like in the US, for example, when there is no family benefits office, the thing is that, of course, providing child support can reduce inequality, but the fact is that there is what we call as sociologists homogamy, which is the fact that, like, poor women are with, like poor mothers were in couple with poor men, and rich women were in couple with rich men. So which means that the redistribution through child support is quite limited if it's only child support, because then you have, like, poor women asking poor men for child support, and they don't have this money. So which creates a lot of problem. I know in the United States of a kind of criminalization of poor and often black fathers, which is a problem that is quite different in France because of the public system. So yeah, so it's a balance between private. I mean, private transfers are not enough for sure to reduce to help reduce inequality. But public transfer, if there is no private transfers, then create also gender inequality, right?
Another question is, and that was also part of the book, which I found really interesting, is the financial contribution that women make to the family, to wealth accumulation. But that, unfortunately, is rendered invisible, or it's not seen really as financial contribution to the family. Can you tell us how that works, or give us an example? What is that financial contribution that women make?
Okay, so we know that during married life, women do 2/3 of domestic work. And in most countries, women are primarily responsible for domestic and parental work. The contribution of men is more or less important, but remains secondary. And after separation, mothers are responsible for the day-to-day care of children in 80% of cases in France. But child support set by judges fall far short of covering the cost of the children, particularly in terms of the wages they cost to their mothers, because they work part-time, because they refrain from taking on the most time-consuming jobs, and the same applies to compensatory allowances. Yet, the domestic and parental work taken on by women enables men to build careers and accumulate wealth that will be passed on to the next generation. All other things being equal, men who live in couples and have children have better careers and higher incomes than single men. And I'm supervising Angèle Janot's thesis on budget arrangements between parents, and she shows that during conjugal life, mothers are in charge of day-to-day expenses, food, children's clothing, medical care, and the characteristic of these expenses is that they involve goods that don't constitute savings, and on the contrary, men pay for car and home loans, and these are expenses that become assets. And on separation, men will feel all the more entitled to keep these assets. But they have only been able to accumulate them thanks to the income of their partners, who have assumed the day-to-day expenses. So the value of women's domestic and work and wage labor is rendered invisible by the way ex-spouses and legal professionals calculate at the time of separation.
One question, maybe a final question that I had is about the legal system, because you do talk about the legal system quite a lot in the book. So do you think it's the legal system and the judges that are sexist, or is it merely a kind of an unconscious sexism or practices that are built into the system? And if so, what is the way out of it?
Yeah, what we say in the book is that this is a logic of practices that are, that this logic of practices, like for instance, the reverse accounting that I mentioned before, like practiced by notaries, lawyers, judges, it's, you don't need to be sexist to have to act sexist. You don't need to have a sexist ideology to have these practices that have sexist consequences. So we met sexist legal professionals and especially sexist notaries during our field work, but most of them didn't give sexist speeches to us. And most of them, even we met. I have in my mind a lawyer, a female lawyer, was like, I mean, super competent. I mean, the kind of lawyer you want to have if you get divorced at one moment. So she was feminist. She was considered feminist by her colleagues, other lawyers in the bar. She was, she had a lot of experience. She, like, woman that we saw in her office, like, she would empower them. She was great. And at the same time, at one point, we realized that she was practicing reverse accounting as well, because she said, you know, at one point you need to be pragmatic, and you need to negotiate with the other party. And so, yeah, you don't need to, presume the intentionality of sexism to observe, like, sexist practices. And with Sybille, in France, we spend a lot of time, like, discussing now with legal scholars, with judges, with lawyers and notaries. They, when they invite us, we go there, and we think that, like, through knowledge, through training, through discussion with them about their practices, like, here is, like, maybe a tool to make things change a bit. And we found, like, that most legal professionals were very open to the to have this discussion about their practices.
Dr. Salim Basir and Dr. Sybille Golak, thank you very, very much for your time to talk with us about the book. The book we discuss is called The Gender of Capital, How Families Perpetuate Wealth Inequality. It's a wonderful book, lots of great theories, practical examples and stories, and also data to back up the arguments. So fascinating read, and thank you very much for discussing your book with us on New Books Network.
Thank you, Morteza.